And good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. Obviously, starting off our Sunday morning sessions here, primarily here with the My Sunday Morning Take on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM, with a little bit of, the war on drugs. That's the band's name, not Donald Trump's perceived war on drugs, which led to 3 January's invasion in Venezuela. And as we particularly take a look at this, almost mid-April, particular Sunday morning sessions, we've experienced, some lovely weather, specifically if you've been here in the central parts of Namibia, primarily from Windhoek, and I heard up until, I think, Otjiwarongo, they've also been experiencing the same rainfall at the same time we were experiencing rainfall. So that means predominantly the central parts of Namibia from Windhoek to Otjiwarongo, that particular distance had some lovely weather. I'd say lovely to an extent. And obviously it's a scenario of also seeing that we are slowly but surely gravitating towards or leading into the cold months, which designates our winter period. It's somehow started already here in Windhoek. Primarily, if you look at your early morning sessions and the cold, or how cold you wake up, or the coldness in the early morning sessions are. But, that's just natural as we can assume and as we are anticipating for the mid-year cold seasons. Now, as we always do here on my Sunday morning take, primarily on your Sunday mornings, we get into the particularly interesting conversations around the developments historically, scientifically, as well as also the natural world in terms of how we understand it and what are some of the interesting things that pop up from it. The peculiar, the outstanding, the, notable in its own particular scenarios. And we take a look at this morning. It's not a truly morbid discussion, but it's a discussion that centers primarily on the ability of how we were able to understand what has been happening in the world or the civilizations that lived before ours. Now, our conversation for this morning, dear listeners, has us looking primarily at things like the You can technically call it entirely like mummification. That is but one of the terms which speaks to the ancient Egyptian mummies and the ancient art of embalming. Even though only, medical outlets and doctors and the likes would be able to know how to embalm. But it had been a particular practice that has stayed with humanity for thousands of years. But then there's also, on the opposite end, if this is for our discussion this morning, a sort of like natural preservation. I'll call it an accidental preservation entity. And it only happens in the Northern Hemisphere, primarily. I have to sort of like, disappoint ourselves in that regard. Us, the Southern Hemisphere guys, primarily because we don't have bogs to mention of or to speak of. Yes, you could probably look at the place known as Patagonia in southern Argentina and southern Chile in South America, but that has a unique and distinct sort of like geography associated to it, because bogs have a particular oxygen deficient variable incorporated into it. The reason why I would call it a variable is because you would immediately ask yourself, but how do you have a freshwater source or a place specifically on land away from a sea that has the potential to be oxygen deficient? Now, if you're going to ask me how is a bog oxygen deficient, I have to stress to you, it's not above the bog, meaning the air that you breathe. I'm talking about the bog itself. And what a bog is that a bog is a very cold swamp. You get a swamp that's warm or is in a moderate climate scenario. For example, if you go to, there's a part of Florida, there's a part of the state of, is it Memphis or is it Tennessee? The state of Tennessee. No, Tennessee is not a state. But there's a part in southern United States, like two or three states, that have swamps, actual swamps, but they're not cold. They are moderate to equatorial. When I say equatorial, they are warm. They're like moderate to warm climate or climatic, geographic locations. If you go to, who else has a swamp? If you go to, there's another country with a swamp as well. Just can't remember it from the top of my head. But the United States one, with its own swamp conditions, it doesn't have bogs. However, you find a bog predominantly in and around Europe and in other places that emulate Europe. However, our discussion for this morning is split into two scenarios. We're going to look at the overall discussion of preservation of people who have passed away. Primarily, if you've watched movies of the like of Indiana Jones and his four movies, National Treasure by Nicolas Cage, if you've played the video games, Lara Croft's Tomb Raider and the Uncharted series produced by the studio Naughty Dog, sure, you would have understood expedition archaeology. They used to call them Tomb Raiders, or because Lara Croft is actually sort of like a pun herself on the actual activity that used to take place in ancient Egypt. Well, not in ancient Egypt, up until now, until the 50s or 60s, when the discipline of Egyptology started becoming a mainstream archaeological discipline, away from the rest of archaeology. Because in many scenarios, the fascination specifically that the Europeans had with ancient Egypt's history, ancient Egypt's particular importance in the Mediterranean cultures. And I watched a fascinating, it was a documentary, about did we have a G8 in human history before? And it was proven by this particular archaeologist and this particular historian that we did have a G8, an ancient civilization G8. It spanned from the ancient Greeks, and they weren't known as the ancient Greeks per se by that name. They had two different distinct civilizations at that time who lived in ancient Greece. You then had the ancient Egyptians, then you had the ancient Babylonians, and there was another civilization above the Babylonians. And then there were the guys here in Turkey. There was another civilization in Turkey and another civilization just immediately above, where we now find modern day Lebanon, Israel, and what's that place's name? Syria. There was a civilization living there as well. But they literally were like eight civilizations. And the description that this particular historian gave was, You had to look at a scenario in human history which emulated the modern day geopolitics that you find today. Now, why am I involving geopolitics into a discussion of mummification, preservation, and overall archaeological subject matter? Well, it's primarily because that's how the archaeologists and the Egyptians, and not the Egyptians, and the historians today could understand what was happening back then. They literally could understand. And this particular one documentary outlined, okay, so what actually happened to these ancient civilizations? How do they just collapse? How do they just break up and don't exist anymore? And obviously, where there's a vacuum, there will be you know, new incumbents coming forward and thus taking the position. Now, starting off in earnest with our discussion primarily, we're going to start off with the mummification and overall preservation discussion, because mummification and obviously the tomb raiding that actually took place before Egyptology became a mainstream archaeological subject matter, a standalone archaeological subject matter and discipline by itself, and archaeology that spanned from it, obviously, also becoming a mainstream discipline itself. There was obviously tomb raiding taking place in what we now know as Egypt, before Egypt's particular independence. Now, the biggest particular concern, obviously, has been a scenario of Egyptology and what people wanted to look into regarding civilization, society, economy, religion, the manner in which the ancient civilizations treated their loved ones, specifically in burial and funeral procedures and ceremonies, and the manner in which, you know, the kinds of people that were allowed to enjoy specifically tombs, I'll say it again, tombs, and not just a regular burial site, was one that the historians today wanted to also get, you know, they wanted to establish certain particular facts. Now, some of the facts that popped up was that the ruling classes, specifically in Egyptology, were the only ones that could afford a tomb. I'll say it again. The ruling classes or the elites within the ancient Egyptian societies were the only ones that could afford a tomb. Yes, so even bare bones economics played a particular part, and economics based upon affordability was a considerable thing as well. Now, the particular indications, obviously, that we now know today come through or originates from the archaeological endeavors with regards to analyzing and basically, looking into the various tombs that still exist within that the Valley of Kings in Egypt, which is obviously known as where the various pyramids are positioned of the various pharaohs and kings and queens, specifically of Egypt, of ancient Egypt, and the other smaller pyramids that also exist that highlighted other significant, you know, officials, governmental officials, and religious leaders of ancient Egypt in that scenario. Now, the only, and this is according to the literature I've got, the only extensive contemporaneous descriptions of ancient Egyptian culture from the outside, were made by classical Greek and classical Roman writers and authors. The works that these particular, similar to ancient civilizations themselves, also depicted about ancient Egypt includes many important observations about Egyptian religion, which particularly also interested the writers, and which until late antiquity, meaning later periods after the ancient Romans and ancient Greeks as civilizations had also collapsed, were obviously a scenario in terms of having the opportunity to look into what is the kind of religion or the kind of culture based upon customs that the ancient Egyptians followed. Now, Herodotus, yes, that's the guy's name, Herodotus, he lived in the 1st century BCE, indicated that the Egyptians were the most religious of people, and the comment was in line because of the popular religious practices that proliferated in the first millennium BCE. Other certain significant classical sources included Plutarch's essay on Isis and Osiris, which are part of the particular ancient Greek god pantheon, meaning they've got a cluster of gods. They're not a mono religious. They don't have a one god. They've got a cluster of gods, but there's a chief god in that cluster of gods. And This is also as Plutarch's particular observations itself gave the only connected narrative of the myth, specifically of the Egyptian religion, and also the writings of Apuleius from the 2nd century CE, and others about the Isis cult as it spread on the Greco-Roman world. Now, in other respects, ancient Egypt has also been recovered archaeologically, like I described a little bit earlier in the introduction, with excavation and the recordings of buildings that have produced a great range of material, from large monuments to small objects and texts on perishable papyrus, to Egyptian monuments that are almost unique in the amount of inscription that they bear. They include vast numbers of texts and representations with religious content, which have been preserved. And you can technically look at this like someone that leaves you a recipe in a cooking book. Now, why would a cooking book be the subject of our particular sort of like description in today's discussion? It's primarily because a cooking book includes reproducible. The ability to play chemist in your kitchen. Not just chemist, but also to manufacture something out of various ingredients. And you feel pretty chuffed. Don't worry, guys. I'm someone that regularly knows how to bake something and, you know, cook something. Because you need to be able to also have, you know, a lot of skill sets or add diverse skills to your particular, you know, skill set as a guy. You need to be able to cook. Now, the particular scenario that obviously emanates from the various observations that came through regarding the ancient Egyptian religion, which were the observations in terms of what could be seen and what could be recorded, was that, as mentioned, the particular indications that obviously came through from what had been recovered. For example, much of the material is religious or has religious implications, and that this particular dominance may be misleading. Yes, my literature uses the word may. It may be misleading, but partly because many of the monuments were based in the Egyptian desert, where they were well preserved. And partly because of the lavishing of great resources on religious monuments that the ancient Egyptians committed to for the kings and the gods, that need not mean that the people's lives were dominated by religion per se. Meaning, it does not mean that the high officials within the ancient Egyptian governance structures were completely religious people. Or that a merchant back then needed to have could afford a big pyramid. No, not in the least. That's why I mentioned at the start of the discussion that it's only certain people of society back then in the ancient Egyptian culture who could afford to have tombs that actually got them. Because economics played a role back then as well. Now, in addition to favoring large monuments and the elite, the archaeological record has other important biases as well. Specifically, that formal cults of major deities and the realm of the dead are far better known than everyday religious activities. This is also another particular surprising thing that the archaeologists discover. The practice in terms of how they preserve their dead or how they treat their passing. Particularly those occurring in towns and villages, and very few of which have been excavated. Now, the absence of material that derives from the religious practice of most people in itself constitutes evidence suggesting that both the inequality of society and the possibility, and confirmed by the strands of evidence as well, that many people's religious lives did not focus on official cult places or major temples. Now, when we obviously look at the discussions, because if we go down the realm of, actual, Egyptology, the discussion itself specifically on mummification starts becoming a unique talking point. But before we actually continue, guys, we quickly take a short musical break and we come back right after this. Coming back there from the sounds specifically of Deodato with the song Latin Flute. We do get into the much anticipated subject matter regarding mummification and some of the preservation details. Now, remember at the start I mentioned we're going to look at two actual realms of preservation that have taken place. The last one, slightly shorter, but it has a unique natural process incorporated into it because it uses a bog. You need a bog to provide this particular preservation attitude. But there's something associated to the findings, the particular locations of these various, you know, sort of like discovered, preserved, yes, human remains. And they even in Europe had to use, you know, sort of like forensic scientists to come and explain, is this someone that passed away recently or is this, what's the situation? Because no one knew that there was such a particular, specific kind of, if we can say rather, deposit of human remains in various locations, specifically in Europe. Now, with the very small view on Egyptian culture specifically and religion that we just had before the musical break, mummification is and embalming, because it's the same thing, mummification or embalming, they play a particular role specifically because embalming also takes place even today. Now, a mummy, which is usually a body that is embalmed, is naturally preserved or treated for burial with preservatives after the manner of what the ancient Egyptians used to do, because embalming is now specifically associated to Egyptology, like I highlighted. Now, the process varied from age to age in Egypt, but it always involved removing specifically the internal organs, and this is though even in the late period, they replaced after treatment and treating the body with resin, which is the particular chemical or particular sort of like substance that was used to preserve the skin and the body itself, and wrapping it in linen bandages, obviously to be stored away or to be laid to rest. Now, among the many other peoples who practiced mummification were the people living along the Torres Strait, which is between Papua New Guinea and Australia, and the Incas of South America. Now, there was also a widespread belief that Egyptian mummies were prepared with bitumen. Not to say that we are now talking about tar road construction. No, bitumen in its own right is a specific kind of a resource. Bitumen is described as a dense, highly viscous and petroleum-based hydrocarbon that is found in deposits such as the oil sands and pitch lakes, which is also known as natural bitumen, or is obtained as a residue of the distillation of crude oil, refined bitumen. So it technically comes from, you know, oil itself and a oil sands, if you know what oil sands are. Now, the understanding regarding bitumen's particular use was that the word comes from the Arabic mumia, bitumen, specifically, which was supposed to have had medicinal value. Now, throughout the Middle Ages, the word mummy, made by, obviously by pounding mummified bodies, was a standard product of apothecary shops. During the course of particular time, it was also forgotten that the virtue of a mummy lay in the bitumen. And the spurious mummy was made from the bodies of felons and usually people who, unfortunately, during the European context, committed suicide. Now, the traffic in mummies continued in Europe until the 18th century. So there was a particular, you know, if you can put it this way, a business of sorts, hence the reason why I explained a little bit earlier with the start of the Egyptology discussion, because Egyptology actually started from, you know, just interested people who loved, like what I love, the subject matter of history, and who decided to become tomb raiders, and, you know, the tomb raiding had taken place extensively during the past 200, 300 years. Well, let me just say, let me just be honest, it could be more than 300 years of tomb raiding that has taken place specifically in Egypt, itself. And the discussion, obviously, that also came about, that comes about when you look at mummification and, you know, the unfortunate negative habits of people, primarily who realized that there were a lot of high-ranking ancient officials that were buried in specific spots. One of the most interesting things was a discussion I viewed. It was a podcast discussion. It's a guy who, he's not a full-on Egyptologist. He's also not a full-on archaeologist because he doesn't have those credentials. But he tried to understand the discussion, the origins and the actual reason why the Sphinx in Egypt exists. You know, what is this thing that has a lion's body but a human's head? And primarily, where did the Egyptians get the idea for something like this? That was the particular premise that this guy was interviewed for in this particular podcast that I watched last year. Now, he explained that the local Egyptian historians and guides will tell you that, unfortunately, the Sphinx itself also was a storage facility of sorts for the you know, ancient Egyptians, primarily that they stored a lot of historic valuables. So this could be anything from copper to gold to other kinds of tributes that were placed there, because the Egyptians were highly religious. They were highly religious. And he explained that grave robbers, tomb raiders in ancient Egypt, primarily, or not in ancient Egypt, but during the periods of human history that impacted Egypt throughout history itself, up until today as well, is that from the invading Arabic tribes and armies that moved into North Africa, to the European invasions, to the ancient European, to the ancient Semitic civilizations. Yes, the word Semite does not just mean Israeli or Jew. Semites mean the people, which also basically includes the Syrians today, the Lebanese, the Jordanians, even the Egyptians today. That whole neighborhood is known as Semitic. So the various ancient Semitic civilizations that lived in that neighborhood of the Middle East, and the continuous, you know, war campaigns that have taken place during human history, have seen many particular grave robbing, many particular tomb raiding taking place specifically in ancient Egypt. Now, they couldn't reach as much from what I could discern from the readings of North Sudan, because North Sudan was an extension of ancient Egypt as well. If you guys never heard of Nubia, if you guys never heard of the particular sort of like periods where in ancient Egypt also had, was at one stage also ruled by, they used to call them the Black Pharaohs. Yes, they came through Nubia specifically. So there was a particular involvement, and there is a particular historical relationship between Sudan today and Egypt today, because the Nile River also flows through Sudan. And since, you know, many civilizations, human civilizations, popped up around fresh water, which was rivers, you just had to follow primarily how far things could go. Now, the ancient religion, obviously, that that the mummification specifically emits from, which is ancient Egyptology, which is ancient Egyptian religion, was that it was indigenous beliefs of ancient Egypt from pre-dynastic times. So we're talking about the 4th millennium BCE. That's before the Common Era, to the disappearance of the traditional culture in the first centuries of the Common Era. So the first centuries are literally after, you know, after Jesus passed, you know, this, what we are now in is known as the Common Era. So all the way up until, Jesus's passing, because Jesus's birth is identified as year zero. If you guys never knew that, year zero, and then you move, as he becomes older, you move into our time period. So everything before Jesus is known as BCE, and everything after Jesus is known as CE, Common Era. Before Common Era and Common Era, which is today. The old terms were obviously known as before Christ, and after him was known as Anno Domini. Just to be sure about that, AD, that was the old particular term that I had to use, which is since the retirement, or no, yeah, advancing age is the particular new term. But Anno Domini means in the year of the Lord, or it technically meant it was a medieval Latin term, which meant in the year of the Lord. So anything after Jesus is known as Anno Domini, after Christ. But it was often presented using, you know, the discussions of the full phrase was actually Anno Domini Nostri Jesu Christi, which translated into the year of our Lord Jesus Christ. So you count it from the birth of Jesus into our direction. Now, when you had to look at, you know, obviously this particular scenario, ancient Egyptian religion and culture technically fell away into the fourth millennium. No, into the first few centuries after the Common Era. So literally even after Jesus, you know, passed away, the next two 100, 300 years after that, the ancient Egyptian religion fell away. Now, with regards to the mummification process and the religion associated to mummification, was that Egyptian religious beliefs and practices were closely integrated into the society at the time. So we're talking about from the century 3000 BCE, so literally 5000 years ago. And although there was probably many survivals from prehistory, these may be relatively unimportant for understanding the later periods of ancient Egyptian culture and history, because the transformation that established the Egyptian state created a new context for religion as well. Now, the religious phenomena were pervasive back then, so much so that it is not meaningful to also view religion as a single entity that cohered as a system. On top of this also, religion in ancient Egypt must also be seen against a backdrop of potentially non-religious human activities and values, and that during its more than 3,000 years of development, Egyptian religion underwent significant changes on emphasis and practice, but in all the periods, the religion had a clear consistency in character and style. Let me explain to you a funny thing that I watched, and I couldn't believe it. It was a way in terms of which Egyptian society was structured. Now, the guy that I mentioned with regards to the game theory analysis, that being the educator, Jiang Xueqin, because I discovered he's not actually a professor. He's not actually a professor. So the term professor was a little bit weird. And when someone calls themselves professor, you go like, what? Without having the particular credentials of being recognized. But he's an educator and he is advanced in this field particularly. So Jiang highlighted a description in terms of how you need to look at the structure of societies today. And there were societies that were based upon, let's rather say, you know, modes of power, positions of where power is positioned. You would have elites where the power and decision making would emanate from there down to the rest of the country and the rest of the population. Then you would have power that's positioned within a single entity, a single person, and this power is transferred from person to person to person. Or you would have a combination of two, for example, like the one that I knew of was, which is also something that I saw later on after the civil war that the English had, they actually technically had two civil wars, the English, but the most significant one was the civil war that came about after, Oliver Cromwell had invaded and, colonized Ireland. And then they literally had a civil war after that because the whole civil war in the UK, well, not the UK, in England at that stage was Cromwell believed that the king should not have powers to make decisions that impact people's daily lives, but that the king should be separate from the decision-making discussion. Obviously, the political supporters of the British king, the English king at the time, didn't like that proposal that Cromwell made, and so a civil war erupted. Now, it sounds very similar to what the Japanese also had, because the Japanese had the era of civil wars known as the period of Sengoku. The period of Sengoku was literally 100 years of civil war. I kid you not, guys. You can go and look this up. Okay, not the period of Sengoku. The literal name is Sengoku Jidai, which is the 100 years period, or the period of 100 years civil war. But the Japanese have had multiple of these kinds of periods of civil war. Literally, every time, because when during their feudal system, they, since they have an emperor or an empress, that person is not allowed to make decisions or any laws. They're not. They're a ceremonial person. Now, if someone is said, you represent the country, you are the country, that means that person cannot get on an airplane, they can't go anywhere else, they cannot act as a head of state in, you know, the traditional sense we know it as. And that person is just stuck at home. However, that person is told that you are literally a national treasure. You can't go anywhere. You don't have powers to make powers, but you can't go anywhere. So, the Japanese emperor or the empress, whichever one is identified as the head of state at that time, what happens is they would then have to elect, that was during Japan's feudal period, they would then have to elect from the nobleman's council, the council of noblemen, a sort of like a military governor, because they were all generals, all these guys were generals, a military governor. Now, what usually happens with a whole bunch of soldiers? There's literally fights going to happen. Because nothing is going to work through a process of election. And, you know, you just, you know, everything that there's not going to be people pulling swords in each other. No. The Japanese literally went to civil war just to select or elect a feudal leader known as a shogun. Or shogun, whichever way you look at it. Now, the ancient Egyptians had a process by which, Jung explained it, the pharaohs had to take on various personalities. So there was a god they had that was the sun god, Ra. Then there was a god they had that had a different personality, and then there was a god that had a different, completely different personality than the other two. And the decision-making and the advisors around the pharaoh in ancient Egypt were all priests. They were all religious leaders. But what they did was they had to set the mood and stuff. And this is according to what Jung explained. They used various kinds of psychedelics. Now, if you don't know what a psychedelic is, a psychedelic technically means a mood-altering chemicals or technically what we call drugs, for that matter. They would use mood-altering chemicals literally to get the desired outcome that they wanted their pharaoh to portray. Now, I just showed you various forms of government that have existed across the world and what they signaled primarily to the ancient civilizations or prehistoric, or not prehistoric, but medieval or feudal periods during societies in the world. Now, since we've reached the midway point of this morning's discussion here on My Sunday Morning Take, we quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after this. Coming back there from the sounds of Groove Armada with the song Romance. Yes, it literally is a breakup song, if you needed to know. If you don't, then now you do. And as we obviously head into the second half of this morning's discussion, just remember that here on my Sunday Morning Take, you're in my company all the way from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. And where we left off primarily was obviously as looking into sort of like the religious makeup and the likes specifically of ancient Egyptian culture, which led to how they treat their dead and specifically those that had passed away, and the particular process in terms of ensuring that there was a whole religious practice around the embalming as well that signaled, you know, the person in terms of their standing in society, they needed certain particular things to also assist them with their passing, heading into the afterlife. But then, as I promised, the second half of our discussion takes a little bit of a peculiar direction. Said particular peculiarity comes through in the format of bog bodies, which are another anomaly of preserved remains of people from societies and civilizations long past. But before I actually rather shift over into the bog body discussion, there's a little bit of a curious piece of trivia just to share with you guys. So apparently, I say apparently because the tomb has still not been found of this very famous ancient Greek leader, the tomb of Alexander the Great is said to be positioned somewhere in Egypt, specifically close to the city of Alexandria. Now, if you don't know, Alexandria technically was named after Alexander. And he did pass away, but it is noted that the tomb of Alexander the Great is believed, I won't use the word attested as my literature outlines here, attested, meaning there is testimony saying, I believe it was over there, but today you won't see it over there, so we technically don't know where it is. But, you know, there were testimonies. So it's believed to be in several historical accounts of his tomb. But the exact location of the remains and the still remains a particular mystery till this day regarding the tomb of Alexander the Great. If you don't know who Alexander the Great was, just like Genghis Khan, or Chengiz was the actual name, he was one of the ancient civilization rulers who decided to conquer, yes, conquer, literally half of the known world. I'll say it again. He conquered literally half of the known world. The known world at that time stretched from Spain, which is the whole Mediterranean region, all the way up until India. The man was in India, if you did not know. So, following his death in Babylon, Alexander the Great's body was then initially buried in Memphis by one of his generals, Ptolemy I of Soter, before being transferred to Alexandria, Egypt, where it was reburied. Now, the Roman generals, Julius Caesar, Queen Cleopatra, and the emperor, the Roman emperor Augustus, were among others who were noted as having visited the tomb of Alexander in Alexandria in antiquity. Now, its later fate, that's the tomb's fate, is also still unknown, and it had possibly been destroyed by the 4th or 5th centuries. Since the 19th century, over 100 official attempts had been made to try and identify the site of Alexander's tomb in Alexandria. Because if you get laid to rest in Egypt, the unfortunate thing is you technically might be mummified as well, just to let you guys know. So Alexander himself, as an ancient Greek, had a specific, had a specific heritage specifically to ancient Egypt. Now, here's also something weird. Cleopatra, the ancient Egyptian queen of Egypt, she was technically a pharaoh because they didn't have queens. They didn't have designations of king and queen, you know, based on gender. She was technically a pharaoh. She was her heritage is to that guy that I mentioned, Ptolemy, the Egyptian general of, not the Egyptian, the Greek general, that was one of Alexander's generals. So Cleopatra had ancient Greek heritage, so technically, you know, she would have been affiliated to Alexander the Great's particular legacy. Now, shifting away specifically from what the ancient Egyptians used to do, the mummification, and the whole discussion of preservation of, you know, the dead in their society, bog bodies have also been the opposite end, or one of the more diverse scenarios that historians and archaeologists have come about or stumbled upon, because many of them have stumbled upon some of these finds in the last 200 years, specifically where history and archaeology have become like these mainstream professions that aim to document the ancient world before our civilizations actually popped up. Now, an interesting read specifically is that a bog body is known as a preserved human remains that are found in peat bogs. If you go look up what a bog is, like I described it to you a little bit earlier in the discussion this morning, is that a bog is a specific kind of a geographic location only found in the Northern Hemisphere, specifically only in Europe and certain other countries that have similar climatic conditions to what Europe has. Now, there are supposedly several hundred variously preserved human remains that were found in natural peat bogs, mostly in Northern and Western Europe, but also elsewhere. Such bogs are anaerobic. So anaerobic is oxygen-free environments. And like I described a little bit earlier in the discussion, it's not that there is no air around the bog. It's the water, the plants, the whole thing doesn't give off much oxygen, even though bogs are found at low-lying areas close to marshes and other wetland situations, you know, in a valley or likes, in terms of where you might find standing water and other things. But a bog has a distinct particular characteristic in that it doesn't give off oxygen. It doesn't produce oxygen, you know? Yeah. It would sort of like baffle you if I describe to you that there's only one other particular scenario on this planet where you get anaerobic conditions, and it usually happens where there's a lack of sunlight, where in oxygen-producing organisms also don't exist. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about the dark, deep depths of the seas, of the oceans. The lower you go in the ocean, the deeper you go into the ocean, the less oxygen you will find in the ocean. Yes, you'll come and ask me, but Dwight, the seas are technically water, and water is a combination of oxygen and hydrogen put together. Yes, I know that. I know that. But what also happens is that the seas have oxygen-producing organisms and entities that we know of. But that's just the top part of the seas. We don't know the bottom part of the seas very much, because it's very difficult to reach the bottom part of the seas. And it has been theorized that the bottom part of the seas does not produce oxygen because of the lack of sunlight. Thus, the organisms that rely on sunlight to produce the oxygen as a byproduct, which we rely on, just like the plants in our backyards and around the city of Windhoek or wherever you find yourself across Namibia listening to this particular broadcast, they rely on carbon dioxide to produce the oxygen at night, not during the day. So plants are not the only organisms that produce oxygen, even though water is a combination of oxygen and hydrogen. There are scenarios where oxygen is not produced on planet Earth. Now, bogs, or the human remains that have been found in these bogs, bogs. Bogs have another particular ingredient that makes them ideal for preserving, animal and human remains that probably passed away in that particular vicinity. Bogs have tannins. Now, a tannin is a group of naturally occurring chemicals that is used in tanning leather. A tannin, for example, can be found from plants, is any of the group of phenolic compounds that are found in woody flowering plants that are important deterrents to herbivores, meaning, animals who are herbivores won't easily eat these plants because they would be able to realize, okay, this is a poisonous chemical. But tannins have a whole bunch of industrial applications that they are utilized for. Now, the tannins, which is used in tanning leather, preserve organic materials such as human bodies, including the soft tissues and the contents of the digestive tract. Bog bodies have been found across various locations, and they sometimes have been found with what seems to be potentially a murder or an act that would describe itself almost as a murder, but they've been discovered with either throats being cut, limbs being severed, broken bones, ropes around their neck, which probably would indicate that this might have been someone who committed a crime back then. Specifically, they suffered a severe injury that led to the death itself. And other particular marks that suggest that the possibility was that they potentially would have been killed for one or other ritual that existed back then. Now, before we continue with our discussion on the bog bodies, we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we'll come back right after this.
Yeah. loving you.
Coming back there from the sounds, actually the two songs performed by the same artist, Richard Ashcroft. The first one was Loving You that you heard, and slightly more, you know, a ballady taste was the second one with O L'Amour, technically also mean something in the range of love. Now, heading back to where we left off specifically on the discussion of bog bodies, is primarily that much of the finds of the bog bodies were, and this is outlined specifically by the literature, that they were typically found during the process of cutting peat, meaning, you know, some farmer was harvesting peat. If you don't know what peat is a kind of plant that grows specifically close to bogs. Peat, a spongy material that is formed by a partial decomposition of organic matter, primarily plant material in wetlands such as swamps, muskegs, bogs, fens, and moors. And the development of peat is favored by warm, moist climatic conditions. However, peat can develop even in cold regions such as Siberia, Canada, and Scandinavia. Beyond its considerable ecological importance, peat is also economically important as a carbon sink, as a source of fuel, and as a raw material in horticulture and other industries. So, the bog bodies were usually found when the harvesting of peat took place, which is the form of compressed vegetation that can be used for fuel and other purposes. Now, this particular situation has complicated archaeologists' particular efforts, yes, their efforts, to understand the processes through which a given body came to be in a particular bog. So, the reason why I said at the start of our discussion today was, if you had to go and look at mummification, mummification had a religious practice and had a ritualistic approach to it. What the ancient Egyptians did, what the ancient Incas did, and what was the other civilization? What they all did was literally, they followed a religious practice. So there was a set system, there was a set cultural identity, there was a set religious investment. However, the bog bodies that have been discovered by archaeologists, specifically in Europe, because there is a theory of a ritual associated to them. I say a theory because I'll go through some of the major finds that have been identified in the last 100 years. It's primarily that you don't know which, you don't know if it was an act of pure violence that had emitted. There was no war setting. And in many cases, the scenario was also that the people were sometimes, you know, reacting to something, or they were part of a potential ritualistic approach. Now, the complication, as the archaeologists identified, was that they were trying to understand the processes through which a given body came to be in the particular bog, as the bodies that are only partially intact may also indicate recent damage rather than actions that took place in the time of death. Now, in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, the use of computerized axial tomography, particularly speaks towards diagnostic imaging. It's a method that is used that uses a low dose beam of X-rays. So it's technically X-rays that you blast onto a surface area to get a scan of what you're looking at. And this helps to cross the body in a single plane at many particular different angles. So when a bog body is discovered, for example, in many cases in Europe, they don't know what they discovered. And at that stage, it's something similar that happens here in Namibia even, that when you hear construction site guys discover bones, specifically human bones, on a construction site in Namibia, then the process has to stop, and that they've literally got to bring in either people from the police, people, I think, from the Heritage Council, I'm strongly emphasizing the I think part. And then there's a third party, a third governmental organization that has to be brought forward, because now they've got to look at how deep potentially was this. Is there a potential police inquiry that has to be launched? And what are the next steps? Meaning, who owned the property where the construction is taking place before the current activity of said particular construction occurred? And, you know, what are we looking at? For instance, the genetic and bone analyses that showed the Windeby girl, a body that was discovered in Germany and once deemed to be a woman because of its slight frame and its long hair, was actually an undernourished male. And the remains are now called Windeby 1. Now, for years, scientists have also puzzled over the death of Grobol, a man who was found in Denmark. He had a severe cut around his throat, and his head had actually looked like it was smashed in, which probably suggested a ritual of several stages, but it now also became known that the damage to his skull was actually caused by the weight of the peat around him. You know, this is obviously as the conditions, the climatic conditions and everything, they didn't preserve his bones as is, but pressure actually forced further damage to his remains. Now, many of the bog bodies are generally reposed in museums, meaning they are displayed in many of these European museums. The Tolland man is perhaps the most famous among the many notable bog bodies. His remains, as well as those of the Elling woman, which were found close to the Tolland man, are on display at the Silkeborg Museum, specifically in Silkeborg, Denmark. Now, when you look up the aspect specifically of the bog bodies itself, you get some interesting particular developments, obviously, that pop up regarding the bog bodies. Primarily that, who they were, what they look like, and stuff like that. Now, the particular discussion was, or is, that still exists, is from which periods do they come from? Because remember, when it comes to archaeology and many of the other particular discussions around the aspect of archaeology itself, is that in many cases you end up with the periods, the societies, the potential environments and communities, and I don't want to say civilization. I don't. Because anything before the ancient Greeks and before the ancient Romans was touch and go situations. I mean it. Anything before them, specifically in the European context, not in the North African and in the Middle Eastern context. I'm talking about in the European context of things. They technically were like touch-and-go situations. Why do I say they were touch-and-go situations? Primarily because if you go and look up alphabets, language, writing, communication, industry, you know, military tactics, techniques, and technologies, unfortunately, if things start from the ancient Egyptians, and then you understand why people would use the word civilization, because they would note certain particular developments associated to certain particular civilizations that existed back then. So, yeah, just in a sort of like summarized scenario, just to highlight that to you. Now, some of the most notable bog bodies that had been discovered, you've got the Eyed Girl. She was discovered in Drenthe, which is in the Netherlands. This is near the village of Eyed. She was discovered in 1897. The estimated age of the person was at the age of 16. That's the estimated age. the person dates back to 170 BCE to 230 BCE. They highlighted the possible, you know, evidence regarding what potentially happened to the person is that it seemed like the person was strangled, and that she was also stabbed. Yes, this is what they can pick up. Now, they noted specifically associated something associated to the eyed girl that a CAT scan, a CAT scan, revealed that she also suffered scoliosis and probably had one or other particular medical condition known as the irregular gait. Now, she was buried in a large woolen cloak at that stage. Then, the next notable find that happened was the Weerdinger couple, or the Weerdinger men. Yes, I'm pronouncing it in Afrikaans, Weerdinger, or Weerdinger. This was a discovery that was made in 1904 in the Netherlands as well, and this was close to the Boortanger Moor. A moor is close to a bog. A moor is soggy. It's a wetland, primarily, just to describe it to you. It's a wetland. The age of death seems to be that it's unknown, but they first thought it was a man and a woman. And then upon further analysis, they realized it was a slightly older man with a slightly younger man who unfortunately, you know, met their demise together. They dated it back to 160 BCE to 220 CE. So it's a pretty big time period. Primarily because of what the preservation chemicals do to the bodies itself, to the human remains. Primarily why you see this massive time span. Because 160 BCE before Common Era, that's 160 years before Christ, and 220 years after Christ was born, you're sitting literally with 380 years, almost 400 years, that these two people had passed away, which is a pretty big time frame. They noted specifically that it was a particular violent death that the two individuals suffered. They do not know how the smaller man died. They do know that the larger figure, the larger man, died by a very violent, it seemed like in a very violent scenario. What was observed in the discovery of the Weerdinger couple was that the tender position of the figures led the observers to believe that the two were first a male and female couple. They were first known as Mr. and Mrs. Fienstra. Fien is another word for peat in Dutch. The experts then since had determined that the second less well-preserved figure was that of also another man. So they did not know if this was probably a homosexual relationship of the two bodies, but they do know that both of these two particular people passed away at the same time. Then you've got the Elling woman, who was discovered in 1938. The estimated age of the remains was at 25. This dates back to 280 BCE. This is the early Iron Age, when they used iron for making weapons and tools. Where she was found was in Beeldskofdal Bog, which is near Silkeborg in Denmark. What the discoverers or the observers discovered of the Elling woman was that she was hung. She died from hanging. A rope made of skin was found with the body, and there was also clearly visible a clearly visible furrow, which is the sort of like the skin damage that a rope makes when someone dies by hanging, you know, that particular mark that's found around a neck. Other noteworthy observations were also made was that her hair was finely braided into a pigtail, and she had a cloak on, which was sewn with a fine thread. A piece of the cloak was also wrapped around her feet. Although she was found 12 years earlier, her body was located, some 200 feet, which is about a hundred, which is about 100 and something meters away from the Tolland Man, which was also another particular bog body that was discovered. The next bog body was the Kulbjerg Man, who was discovered in 1941. His estimated age was also 25 or younger, and this is probably the oldest of the bog bodies, because he was discovered, he's estimated to be more than 8,000 years old, his remains, preserved by peat. Because they estimated it to be back to 8,000 BCE. Now, he was found near Odense, also in Denmark, and the manner of death seems to be drowning, because there was no clear violent, you know, struggle or any signs of a struggle or anything in terms of that. And further observations that popped up was that he is the oldest of the bog bodies. But because of how old the body was, primarily it was also the skull and the skeletal frame was also deformed. Primarily that it was only the skull that was discovered with several bones, and no signs of violence were present. And he was also thought to have been a woman up and until 2016, when the DNA analysis proved otherwise, that this is actually a man that passed away. The Tolland Man was discovered in 1950. Remember, the Tolland Man was discovered just 100 and something meters away from the Elling Woman, also in Denmark. In Denmark. So the Tolland Man was discovered in 1950, and the age of death estimated for the remains of the person was between the ages of 30 to 40. Now, the Tolland Man dates back to 280 BCE, which is also the early Iron Age. So that means that the Tolland Man and the Elling Woman probably lived in the same year. They probably passed away also in the same year. I say possibly, because the 280 BCE is a broad estimation, meaning this could be 279 BCE that the person passed away, the next person passed away in 281 BCE, so there's literally 2 years of gap in between. And they obviously both lived during the early Iron Age, and the person was literally also found in the same bog, the Bjaltskovdal bog in Denmark, which was relatively near the bog body known as Elling Woman. Now, the manner of death that was observed by the archaeologists, or the people that obviously came to investigate, was hanging, but the death also only caused partial suffocation, and there was also a combination of the person's neck breaking with the hanging action. Now, what was noteworthy was that the Tolland Man has the most well-preserved body of all the bog bodies to date. Only his arms and hands are like those of a skeleton, meaning obviously as the rate of decomposition had already taken place back then. Either his clothing also disintegrated or he was buried wearing only a pointed cap made of sheepskin and an oxhide belt. So it also probably speaks towards the kind of clothing making technologies that they used in the period, so the archaeologists could discern, okay, so what happened to his clothing, his actual garments? Why weren't they preserved alongside his actual remains? Or was he just buried as is, with just the little pointy cap and the oxhide pelt, or belt, sorry, the oxhide belt, the sheepskin cap and the oxhide belt? And, you know, why did these two natural fibers or natural products, technically from animal products, survive the particular burial up until today. The Grobol Man, or Grobal, I have to pronounce it like that specifically, because this is also in the Germanic sphere of things. He was discovered in 1952, and his age is also estimated to be in the mid-30s, and it dates also back to the early Iron Age. Now, the early Iron Age is a lot broader than just potentially 280 BCE. Even though 280 BCE was also the early Iron Age, So this potentially could be 270 BCE, 260 BCE, 250 BCE. But the earlier I go, the potential is the quicker I get to the Bronze Age, because there was a time between when the civilizations in the Mediterranean moved from using bronze to iron. And then from iron, they then moved over to, you know, various other particular sort of like metal smithing potential in that scenario. Now, where the Grobol man was discovered was in the Nebelmosebog, which is also once again close to Silkeborg in Denmark. Manner of death was also, it was a little bit severe for the poor guy, because it seemed like he probably suffered an actual crime, like a murder. And his hands and feet were well preserved, as was his face. He also remains, and I've actually got a nice photo here of his remains, because you can technically see the person's face. And his remains are also, he also remains one of the most examined bog bodies, and is believed to have been sacrificed for a fertility goddess after a bad harvest. Now, a particular author at the time, known as Seamus Heaney, wrote a poem about the Grobol man, in terms of that discussion. Now, if you're going to ask me, were they actual human sacrifices before Christianity took hold? Yes, there was. There were religions that actually sacrificed people, because obviously back then they didn't understand a complex system known as the weather or the climate, as we have now developed advanced knowledge and advanced information regarding the climate around us. So when people suffered a bad harvest back then, actual famine kicked in, actual people starved to death, and things were pretty severe. So, things were pretty daunting back then for, you know, communities, human communities and the likes. You then had the Lindorf man, who was discovered in 1984. The estimated age or age of death of the person was the 25 years. I've got a photo of the person also in front of me. They technically look like a piece of paper. That's also how the pressure of their preservation had literally crushed them. The radiocarbon that was placed on, that was positioned on the radiocarbon that was used, because that's how they estimate the ages, indicates potentially between a period of 2 BCE to 119 BCE. Not the oldest, but also not the best preserved, being that the scenario is that the remains of the person is in such a bad condition from the photo that I have in front of me. They were found in the Lindorf Moss, or the Lindo Moss, in northwest England. The manner of death seems that the person also suffered a severe attack, like a violent attack. What was noteworthy about this discovery was that he was given the name Pete Marsh by the radiologist who x-rayed the body, after the radiologist herself suggested that an x-ray which would reveal the presence of fillings in the teeth could determine whether or not the body was actually a modern person that was hidden, a crime that was hidden, whose remains the killer tried to remove and get rid of, or whether actually this is someone that is a historic find. So the Lindo man also wore a fox fur band on his left arm, but was otherwise deemed to be naked. So potentially you can have the same hypothesis as well as the previous bog body, where in the person's clothing, actual clothing, probably might have disintegrated because of, decomposition and obviously biodegradability and all that. The Lindo man was also well groomed, his hair and beard trimmed by shears, and his fingernails were filed, in terms of the period that we're obviously looking at. The second last bog body that was discovered was the old Crowan man. He was discovered in 2003. His age is estimated to be in his early 20s, and he dates back to the 362 to 175 BCE, another 200-year estimated period that they can't specifically say which exact year, but they can just estimate in terms of age. Where the person was found, or where this particular remains were found, was in the county Offaly in Ireland. It seemed that the person also suffered a severe attack, strangulation, stabbing, and he had holes that were cut into his arms, through which it seems like something, you know, was placed. There seemed also to be another severe, you know, action that was taken on his body, for example, like decapitation, but his fingernails seemed to have been manicured. He wore a leather armband and a bronze amulet, and one scholar noted that both the old Crone man and the Clonycoven man had their nipples cut off. Yes, guys, I know. And these were probably, you know, a particular kind of a religious gesture that took place back then. Now, the brutal removal of certain parts from their body also therefore may be an indication that the two were either failed kings or failed candidates for kingship. Yes, back there were certain particular violent societies back then. The Clonycoven man, which is the last of the particular bog bodies, was found in 2003. His age is also estimated the early 20s. Era dated back to was between 392 to 201 BCE, and where he was found was in Clonycavan, County Meath, in Ireland. Also strangled, also stabbed, and also had, you know, various other particular signs of a severe injury, and severe, you know, which highlights to severe violence. What was noteworthy about this particular discovery of the Clonycoven man was legs and arms were both missing. This probably could show the biodegradability, the level to which decomposition had also taken place. And it is also thought that he probably used a product made potentially of a plant oil or pine resin ingredients that were imported from the European continent on his hair. Both the Clonycoven man and the old Crone man are believed to have been, they've had suffered multiple severe violent attacks as a sacrifice to the goddess in their three forms, which indicates fertility, sovereignty, and potentially war and death. And, yeah, that was going through the various scenarios, the natural preservation that can take place, and the actual preservation of, you know, human remains that we've seen happening across human history. Now, we'd quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, before we actually call it a morning here on my Sunday morning take. After that, we come back and we hand over to the next particular program after the break.